from Fairleigh Dickinson University has found viewers of Fox News are less informed about world events than people who don't watch any news. The study found viewers of Fox are 18 points less likely to know that Egyptians overthrew their government, 6 points less likely to know that Syrians have not yet overthrown their government compared to those who watch no news. Fairleigh Dickinson political science professor Dan Cassino said, quote, "The results show us that there is something about watching Fox News that leads people to do worse on these questions than those who don't watch any news at all." And at least 4,000 protesters marched outside Fort Benning, Georgia, calling for the closing of the controversial training base for soldiers from Latin American militaries, formerly known as the School of the Americas. Organizers said they wanted to, quote, transform Fort Benning from a place that trains assassins into a place of memory and nonviolent resistance. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Spectrum Today was produced by Askia Muhammad, engineering by David Kelly. I'm Askia Muhammad. The Raucous Caucus starts now. Thank you for listening.
WPFW, Washington.
Good evening and welcome to the Raucous Caucus, live now. Live at Ben's Next Door. Next door to Ben's Chili Bowl, 12th and June. Mark, Terry, and Garland, three minds linked and locked in analysis, wit, and sagacity. Every Tuesday night, live. Live right here, 7 p.m. WPFW, 89.3 FM. Welcome. Again, live with Terry, Mark, and Garland, and the Raucous Caucus.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of
the Raucous Caucus.
My name's Garland Nixon, and I'm here with two unseemly gentlemen who I don't recognize, so I better ask them their names. This is
Mark Levine.
And
this is the Raucous Caucus. This I could have sworn this was What's at Stake. It's not.
No, it's not
the Raucous Caucus.
Yeah, no, it's I think it's.
Yeah, that's geez. Okay. You can all leave right, Terry right, Kester yeah. if you
yeah.
want.
Yeah.
Garland and I got it covered.
Yeah, well,
yeah they got it covered, but they don't know what they're going to say, and they have no ideas that matter. So it doesn't matter that they're here, but I'm here, and they're in luck. Terry D. Kester is the name. Thank you.
And we are occupying Ben's Next Door.
We are.
Right now, we're occupying Ben's Next Door.
You can join us in our occupation at. What is it, 1211 U Street?
Yes, right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. We're here. There's plenty of room for a studio audience. Come on in and help us occupy Ben's.
And it's been chaos getting us here for a while. No fault of anybody, not blaming anybody, but it's been a bit
I think it's your fault, Terry.
Yeah. No, it isn't, actually. It's your
but we're
going to
blame you
I'm
anyway.
I'm sorry. I didn't want to tell you that, yeah. but she called. She arranged that she had it canceled. What
She's
can I do?
Listening now. You've heard her feelings.
Oh, hi, Mom.
Well, Terry, we don't know whose fault it is, so we'll do the normal thing. We'll just blame you.
Okay.
Everybody needs a scapegoat.
They can't handle it. I can handle it.
But tonight on the Raucous Caucus, but don't forget, 1211 U Street right here, Ben's Next Door. We'll be here till 8 o'clock. Plenty of time to come here. We got an open microphone there with a little red fuzzy windscreen guard on it.
Just
let's not go into that kind of detail
yes.
now, guys.
So. We got big things to talk about here. We got deep things. We got important philosophical things to talk about today. Deep, deep, deep. We're talking about our society. We're talking about let me tell you two quick stories, take a minute or two, and then, you know, I'll get over to you and Mark. Story one, this was about a couple weeks ago, about 2-3 weeks ago, the last time we did our show. I think it was in 87, I believe. Early 80s,
like
the spring of 87.
1887?
Yeah, 1887, in fact, yeah.
First radio show ever broadcast.
Yeah, right, that was the last time we were together. And And I was walking into the station, and I saw a gentleman in a little park there in Adams Morgan, and he's walking out of a store, and he'd opened up, he looked kind of like a homeless gentleman, and he had opened up a can of what appeared to be beans or something. And I'm getting out of my car, and he says to me, excuse me, you have some change so I could get something to go with this? And my default automatic answer was, no, no, no. And I started putting things in my car. And as I kind of came out of that urban trance that we all walk around in when we use our default positions on autopilot, it struck me, wait a minute, the guy is opening a can of beans to eat and he looks like he's homeless. You got a couple dollars in your pocket, give the guy. So I gave him, walked over, I said, excuse me, sir, here, I gave him $4 or $5. I continued and I saw him go right back in the store where he had bought whatever it was to get something else. And I felt, you know, actually, I would say I felt good about myself, but I felt bad because I'd said no in the first place. The second incident, now let me just say this, it brought me back to an incident many years ago that I felt carried guilt with for a long time.
And should have.
Yes, where I was about 20.
I call it white guilt, but yeah. You're not white.
Yeah,
so,
well, you know, I mean, my guilt is, yes.
The whole concept.
Yes.
He's not?
Yes. So, at any rate, I guess I'm kind of orange, I've been told. So it would be orangish kind of guilt if you really think about it. A reddish
maybe,
orange?
Maybe just yuppie guilt.
Yeah. So at any rate,
yuppie?
Bobby, I don't know.
You
so,
called Garland a yuppie?
Okay, he's not, I guess, not really
take that
young.
Take
he's
that.
Urban.
Yeah, I was about to say.
He's
there
urban,
you go.
And I think yeah. You're professional.
Yeah, fairly.
So
at any rate, so when I'm about 20 or so, I was walking into an office building, and there was a gentleman around the office buildings. There was a gentleman who I'd seen many times. He was young also, but he apparently had some mental illness. You know, you'd see he was homeless. You'd see him talking to himself on a regular basis. Everybody there recognized him. And he was saying, you know, can I have some money to get something to eat? And my default position automatically, I said, no. And I said no, and I went on to talking to someone, and I looked at the man, and I saw a very frustrated look on his face. The look was clearly frustrated, like, darn. Well, a few minutes later, I saw him ask someone else. Someone else gave him some money. I watched him walk into a Wolfie's Delicatessen, and he came out with, like, a hot dog and a soda and this huge smile on his face. And I felt so, and I remember at the time I pulled out my wallet and looked and I had $50 in my pocket. And I just wanted to, you know, throw my body in front of a bus. I felt, how horrible is that? Okay. So we fast forward to this event that happened 2 weeks ago. Last event, and I'll throw it over to you guys. About a week or so ago, I was coming up, Connecticut Avenue, Wisconsin Avenue, whatever. And there's a 7-Eleven near the D.C. line with a lot of gas pumps. And there was these two young boys, young African-American gentlemen. They were maybe 13, 14 years old. So they walked over to me just as I went to pump gas. And one kid goes, wow, that's a nice car, sir. And I said, why, thank you very much. And then he said, very, very nicely and respectfully, may I please pump your gas for you? And I knew he wanted to pump my gas for a couple dollars. Again, default position. Nah, that's okay. So I saw the two gentlemen, you know, go walking off. So I went on into this big 7-Eleven. I gave them whatever, and I came back. As I was in there, I kind of drifted out of that trance I was in, and I thought, wow, these two young kids, they're 14 years old, 13 years old. They could be out on the street selling drugs, doing all kinds of unthinkable things, but they are actually at this gas station saying, I'd like to offer you a service, and in return, I'd like you to give me some money. They're actually working. They want to earn some money. That needs to be rewarded. They are going in the right direction. So after I paid the guy at the gas station, I kind of rushed out, and I was worried that they wouldn't be out there. But there they were. I ran all the way over to the other side of the pumps, and I said, hey, come here. So they pumped my gas, and I gave them, like I said, here's $2 for you and $2 for your buddy. Right, whatever. I figured I'd give him something. Well, here's the interesting thing. Meanwhile, just as I was pulling up, there was another guy, African-American man, about...
Is this going to be in the book?
This is the... Yeah. This
okay.
Is the end of... I'm going to get
sure.
To the end of the story. Right? Is it 8 o'clock yet?
Three.
This is the end of it.
You're not going back to your childhood,
but this
are you?
Is the interesting part.
Okay, sorry.
Really?
The
There's an interesting part. Yeah, okay, that's good yeah. To know, because I've been waiting.
At the end of the story, there was another guy, African-American guy, about... My age, you know, 40s, 50s, whatever. Say somewhere between 60s, 40 70s, and 50s, 80s, 90s, 80s. Whatever. My age, you know, born in the early 1900s. And he saw the whole thing. He pulled up at the same time that I pulled up and did the exact same thing. They walked over to him. They said, can I pump your gas? He said no. They said it to me. I said no. He observed everything, and I saw him watching. So after I gave them the $2 each, I saw him wave the kids over, and he gave them each a $5. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, I feel good that somehow that interaction had influence. So anyway, after all that, it brought me back to the thought of how we treat others, the issue of giving. You know, when we walk up and down the street every day, Terry, there's somebody saying, can I give? Can you do something? There are people who want us to volunteer to help. Everybody, you know, people want others to do something to help society. And for the most part, a lot of us, including me, turn our backs on others. And then ultimately we wonder why we look at the policies of our government and their selfish policies and no one wants to help everyone. You know what I'm saying? So let me throw that over to you, Terry. I'm not going anywhere with this story. It's mindless and senseless, as are most of my stories.
No,
so that's
no.
why I'm going to pass, you know, empty crucible over to you to work with.
It's not. It's a very important story, actually, because, I mean, we've all been part of that trend, of that automatic response. But, you know, I had the privilege, well, I can't even say it. Yeah, the privilege. I loved it. Living in Manhattan during the height of the crack epidemic and the height of the AIDS epidemic, you know, all during that period. And obviously there were some economic problems as well, adding to it. Homelessness in New York was just all over the place then. And one of the very first things I noticed shortly after I'd got there is a lot of homeless people, you know, would come onto the subways and, you know, ask for money. The most bold guy, who I really appreciate, came in playing the worst saxophone you ever. He couldn't play saxophone at all. And he'd stand in that car playing the saxophone until people gave him enough money. Then he'd go to the next car.
Tried to get him to stop playing the saxophone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. Hey, I like that.
And he made it perfectly clear. He wasn't going to stop playing unless he got paid. But the other thing that I really noticed is here you are in the subways, and it's packed with all these guys going down to Wall Street, whatever, and all these guys wearing the suits. And here comes a homeless guy, right? The suits would never give a nickel to these guys. The laborers, the workers, you know, dressed in working clothes, whatever, going to a job at a hospital or, you know, or going down to New Jersey to, you know, work in one of the factories or something, whatever, they would reach in their pockets and give. One of an activist I know here in this city I still have respect for is one of the poorest, literally one of the poorest people I know. And he will never turn somebody down. And I've gotten to the point, because of that New York experience, I will never say no. I will say I can't, you know. And the other thing I always make sure of is I make eye contact so that they know that I'm acknowledging them and that I care. And if I can give them some change or whatever, I will. But I make that contact. And it's amazing, that simple little thing of making eye contact and acknowledging that they're there. More often than not, I get from them, thank you, or God bless you,
right.
Even if I haven't given them a thing.
Right.
You know, it's just acknowledging. So I make it a point, and, you know, the other thing is I've learned.
Have a good day, or I'm sorry if you can't give.
And I learned, you know, a long time ago, one of the things, because I've been poor in my own life, you cannot judge anybody. You don't have the right to judge anybody. I firmly believe that. And if you see them in the street, you cannot judge what's going on in their life. And figure out, oh, there's a terrible person, and they're probably going to take it for drink or drugs. You can't make that judgment. You give them what you can. If you can't, you acknowledge that you can't. You make eye contact. You do not judge them and hope that things will work out better. That's all you can do.
One of the nice things about Occupy D.C., I know you both have been down there in
Jersey
Square, and it's not just true of Occupy D.C., but all the Occupy movements, is their interaction with the homeless. It's very interesting because I think at first there was some – and I think it's a very minority. So there's some folks saying, well, wait a minute, we're here for a protest, and, you know, you folks live here all the time. But I think the vast majority of people in Occupy movements realize that, heck, they have it good compared to the homeless.
Right.
They have a home to go to.
Right.
They are choosing to sleep out in tents in the rain. And the homeless don't have a choice. And so what I've seen for myself in Occupy D.C., and I know it's true in most Occupy movements, is the two are combining.
Yeah,
that the
yeah.
homeless are eating at the Occupy places, they are sheltered at the Occupy places, and they give back. And in fact, one of the first things that Occupy DC did, I mean, just recently, was occupy a former homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot its name, though, but you'll remind me. To point out that there's just not enough housing for people in D.C. So it's good that they're working together, because if they weren't working together, it would frankly be hypocrisy. I mean, if there's anything Occupy movement is about, it's about the poor, and the homeless are certainly the most obvious.
And just to add to that, I don't know if you guys saw the paper today, but this really shows you where our country has gone so out of whack. You know, I actually have very little hope for it. I'm really pessimistic about it.
You actually have some?
I do. I have hope in.
You have a little. When
have you ever?
I always have hope in the activity and in the movement. Whether or not we succeed, you know. But anyway, you probably saw this. HUD has been, the funding for HUD has been reduced by 38%.
It's crazy.
I mean, that's insulting. It's immoral. And at the same time, Fannie, and this, you know, Obama's going along with this. You know, at the same time, Fannie Mae has been now going up to accepting jumbo loans again, over $700,000 for houses.
No, I think they rejected that.
No, not as of this morning, unless it's changed since this morning.
I heard they were putting a limit at 625.
625?
Right.
Yes. Oh, well, thank God.
I'm not saying.
You know, but remember, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were set up to help the lower middle class.
Right.
That's what they were there for, to help people get loans who couldn't get them in a normal situation. Now we're going to do it for the wealthy again.
Yeah.
I mean, our society is morally totally out of whack.
And, you know, the discussion we were just having also, I think, reveals something about, you know, the way we see things and the way we all think. Because we're talking about Occupy DC or Occupy movement and how they interact with the homeless. Here's the real reality. If the Occupy movement is truly about the 99%, then they're not interacting with the homeless.
The homeless are the 99%.
The homeless are part of the
99%.
You know, the thing about it is, and I've heard this discussion, the Occupy movement, some people see the Occupy movement, I don't want to get away from it, but this is all part of the discussion. Some people see the Occupy movement as middle class people, a lot of middle class people who got knocked down into the lower middle class and who are upset. When really, I think what it has to be about, what it really needs to be about, and I'm not saying that's what it is, I'm saying I've heard these types of things. What it has to be about is this, that it has to be about the entire 99%, including the bottom 1 or 2%, those homeless people, even more so because they're representative. Well, here's what I think has happened. The top 1% would tolerate, you know, the other, say, 70 on the way down there, you know, kind of being there. And that bottom 25 or so was completely thrown away and forgotten. The homeless, the extremely poor, the mentally, you know, the people who really in our society couldn't look out for themselves, are completely forgotten and thrown, like a throwaway group of people. And what's interesting about what you said, Terry, was this, and I'll tell you why it was powerful. Because what you said was, you see someone on the street who is, you know, in a bad position for whatever reason, and they say, can you give me some money? And you look them in the eye, and you acknowledge them, and even if you can't, you say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't, and they say, bless you, or thank you, or God bless you, or whatever. And I'll tell you what's important about that. Because they are thrown away and forgotten in our society, and I would be willing to bet most people, when they say, hey, you know, sir, can you spare some change, don't even look up to them, at them. Don't even acknowledge them as human beings. And there's a level of guilt.
And for themselves and for the homeless person, and they make eye contact. They acknowledge the situation. They're acknowledging that someone is in dire poverty and in need, and that's a very painful thing to acknowledge. It's easier just to sort of shut the brain off.
Yep.
This isn't happening. The homeless person is not there. Then to deal with the fact that there is this gross inequality in our society.
And if you look the person, let me say this: if you look the person in the eye, if you see a person who's in difficult circumstances, if you look them in the eye, you acknowledge them as a person, and there is a certain level of emotional interaction, and you have to walk away then recognizing these people are here. I can't pretend that there aren't people in our society who are suffering when, even though I may have problems, they're in absolute dire need.
And we have to look at the issue, in my opinion, the issue. You know, the problems this country faces, the economy and the economic mess is a symptom of what is going on in this country. It is not a cause that's in and of itself, or a situation that's in and of itself. And the symptom, and again, this is a moral issue. It really honestly is. We have been taught for decades, and we now believe, and it's inculcated in almost every American in one way or another, that if you are poor, it's your fault.
Yep.
If you are old and losing part of your mind or your health, it's your fault.
Yep.
If you are homeless, it's your fault. If your leg's been cut off and you haven't got two legs anymore, it's your fault. And this culture exists now that if only, it's partly because of marketing, it's partly because of our exceptionalism, it's partly because of me, me, me.
Remember Reagan, the me generation?
But it's constant through the current generation.
Yep.
Everybody now thinks, you know, we really honestly believe it's your fault if you haven't got wealth and power.
Can I just say this real quick, and then I know we have someone here who wants to have his two cents added in. I think the problem, Terry, is to be too broad in broad strokes either way. I think there are people who are at fault for being poor. I'm going to say that. There are people who have a problem or have an issue or something they did that made it that way. And there are people who absolutely, through no fault of their own, are poor. I would also say there are people who are rich through no fault of their own because they inherited a bunch of money, or and are rich who made their wealth. And I think the heart of it is when we try to separate the poor from the middle class or the rich and say the poor are undeserving and the rich are deserving. I don't want to say all the poor are undeserving. Of course not. That's ridiculous. Any more than I want to say all the rich are deserving. At the same time, if you say that all the poor are none of them caused themselves to get there, then I think sometimes it can lead to a mentality where people don't try to rise out of it.
It's irrelevant.
So the answer is we have to help the poor no matter how they got
there. Yeah,
that's
not exactly.
Whether or not
exactly.
they deserve
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
If a person is hungry.
But I'm talking about a cultural thing that is very important to realize here. I mean, you are told if you don't have X car, you know, you aren't really an adequate human being. You are told if you can't have an erection for 4 hours, you are an inadequate man.
Even if you're 93.
Yeah, you know. And it goes on and on in every single way. And therefore, you know, if you're not healthy, well, you weren't, you know, taking the right vitamins for the right period of time.
Your erections last 4 hours?
Okay, we've got a, we've got a loyal member of the Raucous Caucus here. You have some,
trenchant
something important
commentary.
To say. All right. Make sure it's straight. Close to the mic.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah.
Say your name for everyone,
coming.
Please.
Kyle is my name. And I have a question, especially for Terry, because Terry said that this country is morally totally out of whack, right?
Yep.
Okay, my question is, why is that? What's the cause of that? And can we discuss that?
The cause, I honestly think, I mean, you can, there's no one single cause, but the primary cause, frankly, people are going to disagree with me, but is runaway capitalism, runaway marketing, the power to influence people in the way they think and the way they react.
Globalization. Yeah.
And we have really inculcated, as I said, and it's a deliberate inculcation to make the American person feel inadequate. And
that's
because,
true.
And because we all feel inadequate, we're struggling to get...
It starts with Barbie dolls, yes. six-year-old girls.
We've got to get out of this inadequacy. And we got to get ahead of that guy down there because he's holding me back from the wealth and the achievement that I and the 4 hour erection that I deserved.
Yeah, and the other thing is this is you know, capitalism is one way to put it, but another way is commercialism. Let me give you an example. I remember when I was a kid. Now, you know, we say, "Darn, we're in two wars," and every time we turn around, we're invading or attacking someone or whatever, right? When I was a kid, you know what everybody wanted for Christmas? G.I. Joe.
There you go.
They had little toy tanks, little toy machine guns.
And you could kill for only 50 cents.
That's right. G.I. Joe with Kung Fu Grip. You know what you did with the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu Grip? You took another G.I. Joe and you stuck his Kung Fu Grip around his little neck.
That's right.
And you tried to wrench his little head off with the other kids. Hooray!
America,
this is lots of fun. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So, as I say, here you have the military industrial complex through, you know, Mattel or whoever was making G.I. Joe. They are teaching our children that it is a good and glorious thing to grab your other little toy with one toy and snatch his stinking head off and throw it across the yard like a bowling ball.
And that's nothing compared to what's going on today.
Well,
I just wanted to say. Did we answer your question?
Well, okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, I think you guys are on the right track. I agree with what you're saying. I'll try to amplify it a little bit. 5 minutes or less. I think
that's our 5 minutes.
That's our 5 minutes.
Sorry,
you get the less.
Commercialism. I'll use the word imperialism. Is the problem? In other words, it is the goal of the government, and always has been actually, to have a world empire, to Americanize the world, and all of these symptoms that we're describing and these features of society that we're describing, which also address the issue of the moral crisis, all go back to this empire thing, the American empire. And that's what the government is all about. And in fact, the statue on top of the Capitol building, it looks like an American Indian woman, but actually it's Minerva.
Yeah, goddess of wisdom.
Yeah.
And
well,
war.
What that means, and it's Minerva is the Roman goddess.
Right.
And she's standing on the globe of the world. And so the meaning of that statue, the main meaning of it is that it has always been the purpose of the government, the United States government, to be to have a world empire, to Americanize the world.
And there's a good point to that.
American exceptionalism.
I think every country, most every country, kind of wants to.
I don't.
Everybody wants to rule the world.
I don't think so.
Not Costa Rica. The smaller countries don't have.
You know what, Mark? It's interesting.
Russia, China, Germany.
Hold on. If you want to know who wants to rule the world, all you have to do is look at the history of the cultures of and see who did. Western European countries were the one.
Well,
it was France. It was.
I mean, what, you never heard of Genghis Khan?
No.
I mean, right. You know, Peter the Great.
For the most part. Well, you can look at the countries and you can look at the cultures that have tried to rule the world.
Aztec, Mayan. It's a natural human thing, unfortunately.
But here's the heart of it, I think.
Okay.
That whether it's ruling the world or whether it's the kind of what you were talking about, Terry, people looking down on other people. I've always been a firm believer in both capitalism and socialism. I don't think pure capitalism works. I also don't think pure socialism works.
We need a mix. It's a mixed economy.
I firmly agree with that. And the reason I do is that part of capitalism is absolutely that. It's striving to get ahead, striving to make something for yourself, working hard, and believing you'll be rewarded for working hard. And that in and of itself, I don't see a problem with. The problem is that when you work hard and succeed, when you look down on other people, when you say, oh, well, he didn't succeed because he didn't work hard, you don't realize that he was born in poverty, or she wasn't taught how to read, or he had an abusive parent, or she, you know, grew up homeless, whatever it is, or has a drug problem or a health issue. It's when you start saying, well, I can do it, everyone can do it, without recognizing different people's issues. Seems to me the heart of a mixture of capitalism and socialism is recognizing, first of all, and this is socialism, there's human dignity in every person. Everybody has a right to certain basic standard of living, to education, healthcare, food, shelter, the basic stuff. And even though we have a capitalist economy with the American dream, where some people get more money than other people, you can never forget that basic human dignity. And I think that way we combine both in one and say it's okay to get ahead as long as you don't forget where you came from, because all of us are born naked and helpless in this world,
and none of us make it, and so we die.
Right.
And when we die, we're going to die
helpless. And the only way we make it in this world is with other people's help, whether it's our parents or our country
or
our friends or a lot of luck. That's exactly
right.
Well,
and then there's the two foundational myths of the American dream, and that is that everyone can be rich, which is a total myth. And that the only way to be happy
is to be rich.
And so that's taught to everyone. So what happens? If the only way to be happy is to be rich, and the only way to be successful is to be rich, you look at the people who are rich and say they're happy and successful. You look at the people who are poor and say they're unhappy and they're unsuccessful. They're to be looked down on.
I don't think Michael Jackson was that happy. He was a very, very rich man.
Right.
But I don't think his money bought him happiness.
I mean, you're really talking about, and we've talked about it before on the show. I mean, you're really talking about a spiritual dilemma.
Yep.
You're talking about humility. And these things just aren't part of the American culture. I'm not saying that everybody, is caught up in that.
Well, there are elements of the American culture.
And something we want to talk about in the second half of the show, because in a few minutes we have to take a break. And something we want to talk about in the second half of the show is how the term I love to use, the selfishness and the radical individualism, me, forget that poor person over there. I got to look out for myself. How we look at our government that we're so angry at, and we see the individual selfishness reflected in the policies of our government, and we pretend as though that's something foreign to us. How could that happen? Well, if we don't want to volunteer or give a dime or give any of our time to help anybody poor or anyone less fortunate to ourselves. We don't want to do anything for anybody, give anything of ours, and then we're shocked because our government has policies that correspond with the way we act as individuals.
The Congress right now has approval rating of 9%, which basically means that's the approval rating we have for our entire society. You are now.
I am on now. I want to go back to what Garland said about Western European nations sort of being the at the forefront of this effort to conquer the world, to have a world empire. And I think that's very true. And I think to elaborate on that a
history,
little bit.
History does not support that at all. There's a time
period.
The most
powerful countries always try to conquer the world.
Yeah, there's a time period when the Western Europe has certainly been
the last
that,
500 years.
You know, and there's a time period when Asia was that, and there's a time period in certain countries in the Middle East were that, and then there was Babylon, et cetera, et cetera. It changes over time, unfortunately. The world keeps on repeating the same pattern, just moving it to a different country.
Well, what I'm talking about is colonial, you know, the whole colonial thing. The French had their colonies.
Sure.
The Spanish, you know, the British, the Portuguese.
The Americans have their colonies, too. And this is all part of this movement to try to take over the world. And I think it's true that Western European countries have been at the forefront of that. And the reason is because
we're gonna have to get back in a few minutes. So the second half of the show, we got a lot to talk about. This is WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. We are the Raucous Caucus, and we will be back momentarily.
The Occupied Movement has taken center stage on the WPFW airwaves. Every week, we bring you live reports on the ground from the Occupied Zone. Join WPFW for a special town hall meeting on Monday, November 28th at the Martin Luther King Jr. Library, starting at 6 p.m. in room A5. We will discuss how we can better serve your needs through programming content as it pertains to the Occupied Movement. The Martin Luther King Jr. Library is located at 901 G Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. For more information, call 202-588-0999. That's 202-588-0999. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice.
Into the night and back to the Raucous Caucus.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. My name's Garland Nixon. I'm here with
Mark Levine
and
Terry D. Kester.
And we are talking big things. We're here at Ben's Next Door, 1211 U Street, right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. Feel free to stop by. We're here we're not here, but we're on the air every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. on 89.3 FM WPFW
here. And we will be here next Tuesday.
We'll be here next Tuesday.
Well.
Oh
yes,
boy.
We will. That's the
oh
fit,
boy.
Yes.
And if you're out of town, if you're out of the immediate listening area, which is pretty broad, but if you're out of the listening area, WPFW.org, you can go there and you can hear us wherever you may be in Antarctica. But if you have an internet signal, WPFW.org, you can listen to the Raucous
Caucus.
And Caucus.
We have a new Twitter feed that has just been inaugurated this moment. If you want to tweet to us, just tweet to you can be our first follower. You can tweet to at Raucous DC, RAUCOUSDC. Tell us what's on your mind, and we'll address it on the air.
Yeah, at Raucous DC, right about now. You tweet us.
Tweet
for
us.
Goodness sake,
tweet,
whatever
tweet
it is.
Tweet us.
Tweet us on Twitter at Raucous DC, and we will be happy to take into account what you're saying and to respond to it. So as I was saying, you know, we've got this super committee thing going on right now, and as I say, you know, we need to, when we look at the government, when you look at the government and people say, I can't believe what the government's doing, it's like looking at your hand and saying, I can't believe what my hand's doing. My gosh. The government is who we are and it's representative of us. And it is.
I don't think that's true anymore. I disagree.
Well, here's what I mean. It's representative of our society's values because that's what we like. Does it represent us? In a lot of ways, no, it doesn't. But our values, because we overlook people in need, we're a very greedy society. It's all about money. And what is it in Congress or wherever? You know, hey, whoever gives me the money, that's who I represent.
The fact, you know, that we're in a unique situation. Mark was talking about capitalism is okay. Well, maybe a little bit.
A mixture of capitalism.
Mixed economy. I'm with
maybe.
That.
But, you know, we have a situation where the corporations of America created a culture. And in the
culture,
they gained power to the nth degree. And that power is continuous and expanding until we realize.
If you will, the balance beam is weighted too far in the direction of capitalism
too
little.
Way too far. And, you know, I mean, you just think back. Some of you aren't quite as old as I am. You know, most hospital bills.
Most of the world isn't as old as you are.
Oh, it's not quite that bad. I don't go back that far. Good grief.
I think there's some rock. And,
my name is not.
There are some rocks and trees.
And
there's an old tortoise I know in the zoo.
Yeah,
my name is not Cain or Abel. I just want you to know that. You know. But now you made me lose the train of my thought, and it was brilliant.
Aha! Goal! Success!
Yes!
I do want to point out one thing, because I think it's important to this discussion. You know, we're now moving further and further away from government having any social responsibility to begin with at whatsoever.
Corporate responsibility, that's what it has.
Well, and this premise behind this, another myth that has to be defeated, the premise behind removing the national or governmental safety net is that private organizations and little churches in the country will pick up the slack and take care of the poor and the homeless, which is the way it should be in ideal America. That may have worked 100 years ago in some
It did not work 100 years ago in Idaho.
The point is, what you're trying to say is NGOs, non-government organizations, can solve our social and poverty programs in this country. If you want the living proof that that doesn't work, all you have to look at is Haiti. Because every time that there has been a movement to do something about Haiti, it has been this goes back decades. It has been turned over to NGOs rather than government running the situation. It is impossible for NGOs to centralize and to organize to cover the entire problem.
So let me ask
Only
you this.
A government can do that.
Well, let me ask you this. If it's true, Garland, as Terry says, that only a government can truly take care of the poor in a country,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's true. I think the church and other groups can do limited things, some good things, but they just can't do enough, and they never have in any culture, in any country
right.
on earth. Then when you pass a homeless person and you give to them, are you therefore salving your conscience by not supporting the soup kitchen, the homeless shelter, the government policy that can affect the homeless? In other words, one of the things that they always say when there are patriotic millionaires, people like Warren Buffett and others say, well, you know,
I think Terry here, people like Terry, well, patriotic billionaires.
I don't know
left.
That he's millionaire or patriotic, but
certainly not the former.
In any case, but when they say, you know, I think the rich should pay their fair share in taxes, the standard conservative response is, well, then you pay, and that's fine, Warren, you pay, and the rest of us get off the hook. So one of my concerns is if sometimes people say, well, I give charity to my church, you know, I give a buck to the homeless person. We don't need a nationwide policy to deal with the homeless, to deal with poverty. And I just don't know if you feel there's somehow any tension between
yeah.
individual helping and systemic helping.
Good question. That's a good question. And that which brings to mind something that I'm glad you brought that up, because there was something I wanted to talk about anyway, and that was excuses. People often, you'll hear people say things like this. Well, I'm not going to give that guy some money. He'll just spend it on alcohol or this or that. I believe that many times people make excuses for why they won't help or why they won't give or why they won't do things because they don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to give up
no.
a couple bucks. So it's a lot. You want to feel, you don't want to face the music. You know, you don't want to face the reality. I don't want to give up $5. I got 500 bucks, but I don't want to give up $5 to that person. So I have to come up with a reason so I'll feel good about myself by not doing it. I think that happens in a broad sense, too, that when people make these excuses why we shouldn't help the poor or social program, sometimes it has to do with race, they're racist, and they feel like, well, this may go to poor black people or poor Latinos or whatever poor group in their mind they think that it'll go to. Sometimes it's because they're just selfish and they don't want to give anything to anyone else and they want to hold on to everything they can. I think there's a myriad of reasons, but very frequently, just like the individual can come up with a reason why they shouldn't help people, simply so they'll feel good about themselves, I think we do that as a society. So at times, too, come up with reasons not to help those who need help. So we won't have to feel guilty and face the reality that the truth is we don't really want to help them. And so we can just say, oh, well, if we give them money,
and
they'll just do whatever.
And the truth is, as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, the American society, the American citizen, for the most part, feels extremely insecure and extremely anxious because that's what the marketplace has created.
And that's what our economic system has created,
exactly.
where the middle class has been declining
for
decades.
It's designed to make you feel inadequate, insecure, scared. And so, therefore, you've got to compensate for that. And it's a natural reaction to compensate for it by saying, well, at least I'm better off than this person.
Yeah.
You know, and I could be better off, and I might be better off someday. And it's their fault, again, if they aren't.
Because then I don't have to do anything to help them. I don't have to feel bad about it.
We have to compensate for that insecurity rather than realizing that we are all, pardon the cliche, in the same boat. And we are in the same situation, and we're part of the same family. And either we work together and take care of each other and have compassion and some humility, or we throw it aside and become a secular society and watch the rich boys take it all.
And you know what? All we have to do to figure out whether what you just said is true or false, Terry, is look around at what's happening now. Seems pretty clear, doesn't it?
It's absolutely shameful. It's embarrassing. And we actually have the balls to criticize other countries because they tried to have a strong safety net. Countries, you know, be it Greece, be it Italy, be it Spain, forgetting the fact that while they're trying to have a strong safety net, Goldman Sachs is coming into Greece, cooking the books, selling the bonds, speculating, and destroying the economy while they take a profit. And then they say, well, see, they were trying to have too big a safety net.
You know, I was talking to someone.
They didn't have too big a safety net. They were raped by Goldman Sachs.
You know,
Pay attention to what's going on.
I was talking to someone from Greece, a friend from Greece 2 weeks ago. And he was talking about their healthcare system. And I asked him about it. He said, well, he said, even if you're not from, he says, if you're visiting Greece, if you get sick, you go to the hospital, they treat you, they do whatever, they give you medicine, they take care of you. And I said, what would it cost me? He said, nothing. What do you mean? Now, and people say, well, Greece
that's
is broke.
True. That's true in 35 industrial nations.
And people would say, but Greece is broke. Hello, we're broke. We're broke.
We're broke from war
Now, think about this. You've got one country that's broke, but if you go to the hospital, if you get sick, you get taken care of. You got another country that's broke, but if you get sick, you drop dead. You know something? If we're broke and they're broke.
Sounds like Greece is a lot richer than we are.
I was about to say. Yeah. If we're all broke, they didn't spend all their money on nuclear weapons at least. They got taken to the cleaner.
We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world. Statistically, in terms of life expectancy and infant mortality, we're not ahead of half the countries of the world. That's a slight exaggeration.
But not much.
No, we actually have a lower living. We have a lower living expectancy. That's the word I'm looking at.
Yeah, life expectancy.
A life expectancy. We have a lower life expectancy than virtually every nation with national health care. That's like 35 nations ahead of us.
Yeah, and so you might have
Canadians live longer.
Purely coincidence.
English, French,
purely coincidence.
Japanese, New Zealand. They all live longer.
I mean, to give you an idea how screwed up our system is, and healthcare is a perfect example. Did you know that MRIs are the machine, that wonderful, wonderful machine, MRIs, are on the commodities market?
Oh, yeah.
Because they are so expensive. It is such a huge investment and such a huge profit maker for the hospitals, for the company building them and selling them, that it is actually traded the same as oil. Does that make any sense? No.
Think about this. Of all the industries right now, when you look around, a lot of them are in trouble. But I can name two that aren't. Oil companies and energy. And hospitals and healthcare companies. Where's the money now? When people say, well, if a young person wants to get a job or move into, what field should they move into for success and financial success? Well, the healthcare, they're not hurting. They're the only ones not hurting.
No, they are hurting. Hospitals are hurting. But it's, again, because the whole system is based on profit. Everything is measured in profit. If you remember 20 or 30 years ago, and I know you guys are real, real, real young, but the majority of the hospitals and the majority of healthcare in this country was not for profit.
Right.
The majority of hospitals were county hospitals, city hospitals. Yep. Somehow or other, Humana got in there and started to buy them.
That's true. I believe that's right. It started in Tennessee with Frist, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his health service organization.
And now there are very few.
Oh, we've got tweet.
We got two people following us on our new @RaucousDC Twitter account.
Hey, right.
Alex and Diane, thank you very much. Tell your friends we're just starting this. I can safely say that Garland, Terry, and I are all Twitter newbies, trying to do our best and learning the tweet. But if you have a point that you'd like to make, all you have to do is tweet us at RaucousDC, RaucousDC, and we may mention it on the air.
Do they have a point to make?
Well, Alex just says she's following us and tells everyone else too, which I appreciate. So I'll just leave it at that.
So our gracious non-Twitter follower here had another comment.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to try to tie things together if possible. First of all, you were talking about how there's a lack of charity in this country, not to mention other countries. And And my thought about that is it's related to this empire thing that dominates this country, that's always dominated this country. You can't be thinking about taking over the world and Americanizing everybody.
Speak into the microphone a little bit more, so people can hear you.
And be too charitable about it. Those two things just don't go together.
You're right.
Good point.
And then going back to the previous discussion about the Western European countries, it all goes back to the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire was the root of this problem, which gave rise to the other basic global empires, the Portuguese for a while, the Spanish for a while, the English, and so forth.
But there were also Babylonian Empire, Assyrian Empire, there's Persian Empire.
Let me pick up on something real important. You mentioned charity. You know, the proof of our denigration is that charity now is used as an economic issue.
Oh, yeah.
It's a tax issue. It's a profit or not-for-profit issue. Now, if you do any scriptural study at all, charity is not about economics.
It never
charity
has
charity is actually about love.
Right.
Now, we don't even pretend to understand anymore. Charity now is a tax.
It's actually also about inequality. One of the things that I think shocks most people, you know, a lot of people who say, well, I'm a fundamentalist and I'm a Republican and I'm a real believing Christian. And you point them to the part in the Bible where not only do they have to leave part of their fields left for the poor to take what they could, but every 49 years, 7 times 7, the 50th year was called the Jubilee year, and everybody redistributed their property. That was it. You were allowed to gather up as much as you could for 49 years. 50th year, Jubilee year, all the property gets redistributed to everybody equally, recognizing that everyone has equal human dignity. Now, there are people that say they are Bible-believing Christians.
They haven't
read
that part.
And yet they talk about a capital gains tax cut instead of talking about the Jubilee year. I mean, look, I don't mind if you want to say you're a Christian and you care about the poor, that's great. But if you say you're a Christian and you say you don't care about the poor, or you say you're a Jew or a Muslim and you don't care about the poor, then all I can say is you're not a very good Christian
and
Jew
or Muslim. And you haven't read what you claim to be part of and haven't understood it. And isn't there a section, I'm pretty sure, too, at least in Jewish tradition, if not in the Old Testament, where every 7 years, something like that, debts are forgiven.
Debts are forgiven
hello,
every
Goldman
7 years.
Sachs, hello,
no, debts that's right.
are forgiven.
Every 7 years,
try
debts
it.
Are forgiven.
Just try it once.
That's right. And every 7 times 7 years, that's when all the property is redistributed.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Good. It's
when
a very socialist
Sachs
idea.
And, you know, and J.P. Morgan to agree to this,
I
got some.
Don't think.
Which is interesting because, you know, I'll tell you what's interesting here, too, is we've got a very weird clash right now in these of cultures and of politics that's very, very odd mix. And I'll give you the three, okay? You have the Occupy movement, which is more of a left-leaning movement, which is saying, look, you know, we're being had by the wealthy, but really – we're being had kind of by the government, by the wealthy through the government. They're
crony
owning the government.
Capitalism.
And so, yeah, crony capitalism. They own the government. The government doesn't listen to us. They get everything they want. We get the shaft. Okay. You've got that. Then you have, a far right wing kind of movement, which interestingly enough, when you look at the right, when you look at, say, the Republicans or the right wing, there's the top 1%, you know, the Bushes and the Cheneys, their socioeconomic class. But then you have the Tea Party movement, who are down there with the Occupy people, who are middle class, who are lower middle class, who recognize that something is fundamentally wrong and they are being had. Now, are they misguided? Yes. And they are, kind of, oddly enough, this group is – They've been co-opted by the wealthy through money and the Koch brothers.
But the similarities are very interesting.
Yeah, because what I'm saying is they are unfortunately supporting the same positions that got them there. But the issue being, you've got on both sides of the aisle, you've got people who are in the same socioeconomic class recognizing we've been had. And there's this weird
they're
mix.
They're blaming different people. I think if you look at them, I think you see that the Occupy Wall Street mostly blames Wall Street and capitalism and corporations, but also definitely blames the government for helping corporations
get there.
The Tea Party mostly blames the government for all their misfortune, but they also blame Wall Street and corporations for infecting the government
that way. And unfortunately,
the poor. So really, other than, you know, the Tea Party, I don't know that there's so much blaming the poor as they're blaming the government for helping the poor, which I don't know if that's the same or different.
No, it's not that. It's the Tea Party and the people in a lower economic class are literally angry, very angry, because they're saying, how come this isn't working for me?
Right. That's it.
Why haven't I achieved the American dream?
I'm told that it's going to work for me. That's all.
I'm working hard. I got 3 jobs.
And it's not working for me. And now I've got a job again that I used to have $20 an hour. And now I'm getting paid $7 an hour. And it's got to be somebody's fault. And understanding what's really going on in the broad sense that we're talking about does take some work, some research, some study. It's a lot easier, and that's what it comes down to, for a politician or a Tea Party to say, oh, we need one target. Let's have the government be
Well, but it's very interesting because I think it's exactly right. I think you have middle class people, whether it's lower middle class or middle class, struggling to achieve the American dream and not succeeding.
Or even survive now.
And Occupy Wall Street says it's the corporations that are putting us down. It's the rich people putting us down. It's the 1%. And then you got the Tea Party saying, no, it's actually the poor attacking the middle class because they're taking all our money to the government and giving it to the poor. So the middle class blaming the poor. If you're middle class, you're blaming the poor. You're a Tea Party.
Well, you know
what? If you're middle class, you're blaming the rich. You're Occupy Wall
Street. Well, here's what I would say.
Let me throw this. That is realistic. The other part isn't.
Here's something I got to throw in about that, and that is this, of what I think about the Tea Party. Initially, the guy who started the Tea Party, if you've seen him on TV,
Rick Santinelli.
Yeah, this guy has completely divorced himself from the Tea Party, and he's angry, and he says they've been co-opted by the very people that I started the Tea Party to fight against. So what I see is this. Now, you know the way it's always worked. The super, super wealthy, the kings and the earls and the dukes, they get the other people. They get the people who have everything in common to fight against each other, and they say, well, this person's the wrong race, this person's the wrong religion. They get the Tea Party and the Occupy people to see each other different for whatever reason, race, religion, ethnicity, you know, sexual orientation, etc., and they get them fighting against each other. And I think part of what's going on with the Tea Party is this. The super wealthy, in co-opting them, are saying to them, it's not us. We're on your side.
We want you to be rich too. You know who the fault is? Just as soon as you buy Viagra, you'll be okay.
It's those poor people over there. It is the super wealthy.
It's
manipulating
the poor people. It's the blacks. It's the Jews.
It's the gays. It's the immigrants.
The other person. That's right. The immigrant.
The people who are in the same exact socioeconomic class as you are, they're to blame, not us. In reality, what they're saying, remember Herman Cain? It's your own fault.
That's right.
That's
exactly what he said.
So what? We laid out 50,000 workers and split the money between the six of us here. It's not our fault. It's yours.
The Tea Party, I think, now is related to the Tea Party in the past, meaning the Boston Tea Party. I think they are the same thing, the Sons of Liberty. They're the ones that started this country. And that's the problem, because the people.
Oh no! I'm sorry. You know, I'm you know, ex-official historian. I've worked for Mount Vernon.
They were anti-corporate.
I've worked for Colonial Williamsburg. The Tea Party, for the most part,
the East India Tea Company,
was a group of people again manipulated by very powerful forces to do some raucous and ridiculous things.
Well, maybe
you can say
they
that fine sparked the revolution. They had no understanding of what was going on. They had no understanding of why England wanted to raise the taxes, which all had to do with land speculation by the very rich in this country and the British Army and the
They also opposed the East India Tea Corporation, one of the earliest multinational corporations in history.
But the East India Tea Company was just part of the equation. The thing was, the British Army said, they drew the line of demarcation and they said, we're not going to let you go further west because we can't afford to defend you. If you want to go against the Indians, if you want to go further west with all your land exploitation, you're going to have to pay for it. Guess what an idea? Pay for your own war. You're going to have to pay for it through taxes. And
well, we don't like paying for our own wars
we're
in America.
We're not going to pay for our western lands that we're exploiting and speculating on. We've got to go to war. We've got to have independence so that we can continue this economic exploitation. How's that for a little short lesson of history?
Well, I think the Tea Party now and then are related to this empire thing.
Yes.
Because they are tools. What they are is Freemasonry. They represent Freemasonry. That was what was behind it. And no. This is what Freemasonry is really all about. It's about the Roman Empire and that whole legacy from not just the Roman Empire, but as you say, going all the way back to the original superpower, the Babylonian Empire. There's this superpower movement throughout history, and Freemasonry is very much a part of that.
I think there's always been groups of people who are trying to control groups of other people, probably since before recorded history. Yeah, probably since we evolved from
the days of fangs and claws.
I mean, in tribal societies. The trick is, I think, there's also always been a countervailing force. There's always been people who've tried to work in a community. Like I said, one of the nice things I like about Occupy DC, they formed their own community. You know, they got their food and their library, and everyone has to chip in. You know, they have to help out, and they have their own order, their own society. And I think that is the inherent tension of just being human. This focus between order, between controlling others and helping yourself.
And let me throw this in there. Let me throw this in.
I want to, because you taught me on this, Garner.
Uh-oh.
You know, the story of B.
Yes.
There is a whole other way of looking at life.
Yep.
Which Americans at this point refuse to do. And that is a way of looking at life. And again, the book is the story of B.
Daniel Quinn, right?
Right. And the premise is, and other societies have done this and survived quite well, is realizing that you are all part of something much bigger than the individual. That includes ecology, nature, each other.
In its best light, that's what religion does. Religion often fails in this regard, but in its best form, that's what it does.
But it really separates the people out between the takers and the givers.
Yeah.
And our society is a taking society. We'll take the oil, we'll take the gold.
What I can do for my country, ask what my country
can do
for me.
Yeah. And just like we pretend as though the laws of nature don't apply to us.
Yeah, right.
They apply.
Well, we have dominion, remember?
And the things that are going on right now and what's happening now didn't happen in a vacuum or just isn't by happenstance that these things happen.
Nope.
They are happening based on the way our society is operated exactly as they should happen. But what has to happen now is we got to thank some people. We've got to thank Daniel.
Oh, yeah.
Who's Daniel, right here helping
who's
us?
Right here?
Ben's
who do we have?
Door.
We got someone.
David Kelly over there. David in the Kelly. Studio. Hello.
Thank
David.
Our audience for coming.
Yes. Yeah.
Very much.
Yes. And we're here every Tuesday. Not here, but we're on WPFW every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. here on 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. If you're out of town, go to WPFW.org at 7 p.m. We'll be back next week to talk.
We'll
be right
here at Ben's. You can join us at 1211 U Street. You can also tweet us at
new
tweet address at Raucous DC, RAUCOUSDC.
And there will be a pop quiz because this show has really been hot, guys.
Yes,
it's
sir.
Really been hot. There's going to be a pop quiz.
So, Mark, if someone, not that anyone ever would, including Terry or I, but if someone would ever want to contact you, how would they do it?
They can find me on Twitter myself at Mark Levine TV or at marklevine.tv, which is my website.
Marklevine.tv. I like that.
Marklevine.tv.
Terry.
WPFW.org is still the best way. I am creating a website, but I have no idea why.
And you can just, you can Facebook me. Garland
I'm on Facebook
Nixon,
too.
Garland way. Nixon, GarlandNixon. Or if you want to email me, garlandn@gmail.com. So all those things are good. You know, at Garland Nixon on Twitter. All the Garland Nixon is pretty much how it works.
Oh, and I got to mention real quick, if we have 1 second, do we have 1 second?
1 second only.
Go ahead.
December 6th, Greg Palace coming in Silver Spring. And it's going to be a great thing there. It's a WPFW fundraiser. He's going to be there for an hour and a half with his books.
You're talking too fast.
I'm talking too
Greg
fast.
Greg Palace.
We'll talk about it next week.
He told me I didn't have any time. Oh, I have a minute.
You have a minute.
Oh,
slow
well,
down.
In that case, hi, guys.
Greg Palace.
I'm Terry DeCester.
Now you've used up 30 seconds.
Greg
Go.
Greg Palace, December 6th in Silver Spring. Go to WPFW.org. Buy your tickets for it. You get two tickets for one price. You get the books. You get to get the signed books. You get to have Greg Palace.
And please come here next week to Ben's. We'd love to fill up this room and have you eat a nice meal and join us here on the Raucous Caucus.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun. We got open space on the mic, and we're going to have a great time. We're here. I think we're trying to change the world, aren't we?
I'm trying, step at a time. So come occupy Ben's with us next week.
I'm Garland Nixon with
Terry DeCester
and Mark Levine.
And we'll talk to you next week at 7.
WFW Washington.
Mm-hmm.